Well, thanks very much for the invitation to come here. It's really great to be here, and I look forward to get back into sand research. I became interested in sand, the Aeolian sand transport, a long time ago. This is an old photo I started when I was invited to become a member of the so-called Aarhus sand gang that was sort of headed by Ole Barndorff Nielsen, who is here pointing the way into the future as usual. And here's Bagnold wondering what's going on. So I started there already when I was a student, and in fact Kjell became one of my PhD supervisors. So I've been doing this for a long time, but in recent years I have mainly been working on stochastic differential equations. So I look forward to get back into the sand research. So what I will do is, since I did not really publish anything in the last few years, I will talk about some of the things I did previously, and I'll try to bring it a little bit up to date. So I will talk about transport rates. As we heard in Alexander's talk, this is obviously a very important problem. And how does the transport rate of sand depend on the wind? So the transport rate, so that's the mass flux over one length unit perpendicular to the wind per time unit. And if you do some calculations, you'll see that it can be written as a product of the mass flux from the bed into the air. So that's the mass flux from one square meter per second from the bed into the air, and then times a typical jump length for a grain. So later we'll have a model for grain trajectories. So XT is the horizontal component of the grain path, and TI is the impact time. So this is the jump length. So the mean jump length times the this mass flux from the bed into the air. So one way to study this is certainly to study these two quantities separately, see how they might depend on the wind speed. Well, let's first look at this flux. And, well, I should also say I learned a lot from Paul Owen. I had the good luck to talk to him a lot in the early 80s. But he introduced this idea of separating the, so this is the shear stress up in the grain free wind, and so he proposed to this idea that it was separated into a grain-borne shear stress and an airborne shear stress. So the grain-borne shear stress at height y, so that's the force exerted on the wind by the grains that are above height y. And if you do some calculations, you can see that can actually be written as this flux phi times a function v of y that is so it's equal to the average increase of the horizontal velocity component of a saltating grain while it's above the level y, or if you write it so mathematically, so this is so t, so the grain goes up, and at time t one y it is the first time it comes to the level y, and t two y that's the first time it is at level y on the way back, and so the increase of the horizontal speed, and well, this is an indicator function saying that we should only average over trajectories that are high enough that they actually reach the level y. And U star is usually is the friction speed or shear velocity up in the grain-free winds, and rho is the density of the air. And here's this, well, if it was not clear, then there's a small drawing. So here on the way up is the horizontal velocity component, and here is the horizontal on the way down. So it's the difference between this and this averaged. That's our function v. Let's assume that the airborne shear stress at the bed is some fraction of the total shear stress in the grain-free region. So let's call this pi. And then at the bed, the sum of the airborne shear stress and the grain-borne shear stress should, according to Owen, be equal to the total shear stress in the grain-free area. And if you, yeah, from this, it's a simple calculation that phi can be written like this. So, well, probably this pi will depend on the friction speed. And then there's this function v at zero. The grain-borne shear stress at height y, that was this guy here times the function v. So if we introduce this function a, that's v divided by v at the surface, then the grain-borne shear stress is given by this. So this function is obviously very important. So that tells us how is the grain-borne shear stress distributed with height.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
What's the motivation of the first line?
This?
Yeah.
Well, you can say it's just a definition of pi. So pi is just some function of...
Could it then depend on u star? Or is it a constant?
Pi must obviously depend on u star, or most likely. So that's a quantity we would like to determine and find out how does it depend on u star. So we would say it's just a convenient way of rewriting the problem. Which, however, fits nicely into the way Owen thought about the problem, as we shall see. Well, Bob Anderson proposed to introduce a sort of height-dependent friction speed or shear velocity, which is simply defined as it's simply the so you take the full or the shear stress in the wind-free region minus the grain-borne shear stress divided by rho and take the square root. That's the definition of it. And if we introduce the notation I just introduced, then there's this simple expression for it in terms of pi and the function a. Then so I have these two papers in 1991 and 2004 where I derived formulae for the transport rate. And in both of these papers I used, well, this square root is a nuisance. You would like to suitably linearize the problem to be able to actually do calculations. So I did this somewhat crude approximation. Well, I wanted something that was a good approximation. So obviously the x here, that's this guy here, it's a number between 0 and 1. This pi is between 0 and 1, and a is smaller than sort of between 0 and 1. By definition, so I just made this to linearize things. I made this is a not it's a somewhat rough approximation, but it's certainly good close to one and close to zero. And if you do that, then you get this time dependent shear velocity. Well, in a paper by Duran and Hans Hermann, it was pointed out that there are some unfortunate consequences of this assumption. If you go down to height zero, then obviously you get this, because at zero A is one by definition. So we get this, and then if you try to calculate the airborne shear stress, that should then be rho times this guy squared. Then you get pi squared times the total shear stress, which is different from this, and this by definition this is airborne shear stress, because that's how we defined pi. So close to the beds, this is not a terribly good approximation. And so certainly I have to admit that that's a pretty fair criticism. But there's a very simple solution to it, because I made this approximation to have a good approximation in the whole interval from 0 to 1. But in fact, the largest possible value of x here, that's actually 1 minus pi, because a is smaller than or equal to 1. So we really need only a good approximation from 0 and up to 1 minus pi. So if instead I use a line that goes through this function here at 0 and at 1 minus pi, then we get this approximation, which will give us this height-dependent shear velocity. So okay, let's do as Hans Hermann says and use this instead. But otherwise, I will do as I did in my previous papers. So this is what I would call an update of the previous work. So we use an eddy viscosity closure of the turbulence, get this equation for the wind profile, and with this solution, where B is now this function here. This is a nice expression, except we do not know how this depends on the U star, and we do not really know this function. It depends on this A that tells us how the grain bond shear stress decreases with height. So, but at least we have reformulated the problem in a way. Now, an assumption that sort of lies behind most work in this area that's usually implicit is that this function here does not depend on U star, so that we have only the dependence on the wind here and here. Usually the assumption is implicit, but
you actually integrate that equation in the way that you have it with this implicit dependence of pi and U star.
Sorry?
You've integrated your equation, haven't you? But you're sort of saying that pi is really not constant, but it's a function of U star.
Yeah. But U star is constant in this.
Oh, you flipped it.
Yeah. So it's only y that's
a U star. Not a function. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not this U star. It's the free grain-free U star. So what's really behind this is the assumption that, well, I've tried to make a small drawing that. So the idea is this, that as the wind speed increases, what happens is that you get sort of more and more grains in more or less the same area, but the grains do not jump much higher. Of course, that's not exactly true, but that is sort of the basic assumption that there is a. The grain-borne shear stress, of course, increases with the U star, but the way it's distributed with height remains, at least in the theory, the same. But, so we say it remains approximately constant. that is an assumption. There is some empirical evidence for it. I tried to find the reference over the weekend, but I couldn't find it.
We have some nice fountain.
You have some, excellent.
This is fairly approximation.
Yeah, in fact, we also had some in some work we did back in the 80s. We did some analysis of some very old data from the 60s of Williams that also indicates this. But since these are so old data, I'm not sure how much I really trust it. But, so there is some evidence around that this is not such a bad approximation. Okay, now to get on, I need a model for the grain motion. So here are the equations of motion. If you assume that only gravity and drag are forces that affect the grain motion. So h here is a drag coefficient at the relative velocity v, m is the grain mass, the grain starts at zero, and with this random initial velocity vector. These equations are coupled in a nasty way by this relative velocity. So Owen proposed to make a linear approximation to the drag coefficient so that the function h would actually be constant and can be interpreted as the inverse of the response time of grains to changes in the wind speed. So it's a relaxation time of grain motion. This linear approximation should, of course, be chosen so that it's a good approximation for relevant Reynolds numbers. The Reynolds numbers are not very small, they're also not very large, so it's in an area where the drag coefficient is really not linear. But it's a good enough approximation to get a reasonable model, and it certainly makes life much, much easier, because now we can solve the equations. And we have an expression here for the x component of the grain motion, which is what we need for the jump lengths. Here for the y appears a quantity vf, which is this relaxation time times g. That can be interpreted as an approximate terminal velocity of fall for the grains, in fact. But that will appear also other formulae. But this is what we need, because now we can plug in our expression for the wind profile here, and then average. So here's the x. We plug in the expression we found for the wind profile, and then we average over all the possible initial velocities of the grain. And then we will assume that this function here does not depend on u star, as I said, so that we get constants. Yeah, and the u star is here and hidden here. This term does not depend on u star. That's really just what happens to the initial horizontal component of the grain. And here was our expression for phi that we can put in here, and then we get this expression for q, the transport rate. Here I've normalized it by the Bagnall formula to get a dimensionless transport rate. So we have these three quantities that are related to these expectations it will depend on the type of sand in question, so that should probably be determined empirically. And then there's the pi. So now we need to say something about how pi depends on u star to get on from here. you know, so far I have not really assumed anything about that this is saturated transport. I've just assumed that the airborne shear stress at the bed is some fraction of the total shear stress. And well, if the wind is changing sufficiently slowly, then you could even think of this as a function of time and have some see how the transport rate grows with slow changes. Yeah.
You said you are in this averaging is over all the possible initial conditions.
Yeah.
But these initial conditions may depend on the impact conditions. Do you take that into account in some way?
In the next slide, I will assume that we are in a saturated, so in a stationary situation. And so then it is, so then it is sort of the stationary version of it. Okay, so you're saying this could also depend on U star. This is an assumption that it doesn't. Or at least that it depends on in such a way that these are constants. But that's certainly something to worry about, that's true. Well, Paul Owen made the hypothesis that the airborne shear stress at the bed is equal to the shear stress at the so-called impact threshold. So that is the the smallest U star value where saltation can be maintained. So for U star smaller than this critical value, saltation cannot be maintained. Well, that makes a lot of physical sense, and it implies that pi is this ratio between the critical U star squared and the U star squared in the grain free layer. And if we introduce this natural normalization of the shear velocity, so we have this dimensionless version of it, then pi is v to the minus 2. And if we introduce that, well, then our formula for this flux from bed into the air for the grain-borne shear stress and for the wind looks like this, and not least we get this formula here for the transport rate. But if you multiply this here by U star squared, then you get this shield. Essentially, this shield parameter that Alexander talked about, minus its critical value. But it's, well, a different formula for sure. It's interesting to discuss in what ways. Well, this, at least for me, is interesting to compare to the formulae I found in 1991 and 2004. Well, if we compare to the 2004 version, then the 2004 formula was more complicated because it had this extra term here that simply appeared because of this, not so good approximation that I made, not sufficiently good approximation that I made. So if you make a better approximation, this term disappears, and you get this formula. Well, this is what I got in 1991, because there the physics was different. That's why I got a rather different formula. So if you rewrite this in this way, then it's you see that this formula is actually simpler than what I have just derived in that, that this term is not there. What I did here was to impose on the wind profile so-called Becknold focal point. So Becknold claimed that there's a certain height at which the wind speed does not depend on U star. So I imposed that and came up with this. It turns out that if you do this Owen assumption that I did here and here, then it's in a way there cannot be a focus point. But I'll discuss it in a while. Let me just show you. This is from the 2004 paper, and here are the three. Let's see, the parameter that disappeared is the gamma parameter. So we are here fitted. So this data that Keld obtained with Jim Iverson, and here for so artificially homogeneous sand of this size. And here are the parameters that I got. And you see the gamma parameter is certainly not zero in this case. And here is some natural sand from a dune area, in fact, the same dune area that I showed you a picture from earlier, Robbie Amine. Again, the gamma parameter is certainly not zero. So I'm a little bit worried about the new theory. But let's try to take this Becknold focal point seriously. So here's the wind profile with the Owen assumption. Well, it can actually be rewritten like this. So here we have what depends on U star, and what we have here does actually not depend on U star, simply by the definition of V was U critical divided by U star. And well, if we suppose that there is a height where this does not depend on U star, well, so this is its height. Well, the only way that can happen is if this is zero. So this has to be satisfied. But by the definition of B, this difference is given by this, and A is smaller than one. So this is clearly positive. And the only way that we can have equality here, if we are so close to the bed that this A y bar is actually one, so that we essentially get a zero here. And in that case, we will have this equality not only for one, for y star, but actually for all y below y star. So that would mean that this focal point is very close to the bed, and it's actually not a point; it's a small cloud of where the wind speed does not depend on U star.
Let's see if Owen assumptions is if Owen's assumption is true, and the focal point exists, you're led to this conclusion.
Yep, and if all the other derivations I did were right.
Yeah.
So in a way that they do not go very well together, the two. So what can we do about that? Well, let's go back to the what I had before the Owen assumption, and then let's see that. So by the definition of pi, that must be. So pi was the ratio between the airborne shear stress at the bed and the airborne shear stress in the grain free layer. So therefore, the square root of y must be the ratio of u star and this airborne u star close at the bed. And if we introduce that, then we can write the wind profile in this way. Okay, and then let's assume that there is a height y bar where this does not depend on u star. Well, then, first this what we have in this squared parenthesis divided by this, we can write like this. So where mu is this logarithm divided by b of y star. And as we saw before, this is a number larger than or equal to 1. And then if we differentiate this with respect to u star, then we get this very simple differential equation, which, well, of course, we can all solve. So we get this linear relationship of this. Okay, I forgot to say something. I forgot to say that I make the assumption now that this u star at the bit is a function of the u star and the grain free layer. So now we're really trying to determine how does pi depend on u star. So that's what I'm doing. Sorry, point that out. So we get this linear relationship. We have to determine the constant kappa. But at the critical friction speeds, well, there the friction speed is equal to this airborne friction speed is equal to the total friction speed, because there's no sand transport at that time or at that value. And this is equal to this immediately implies that kappa is given by this, and we have this expression here for this airborne shear velocity at the bit. And we can also see that Owen's hypothesis corresponds to putting this mu equal to 1, because then this disappears and we just get the critical value. Okay, and we can also see that it's a decreasing function of u star. Of course, we cannot have a decreasing linear function of u star for all u star values. That's because this has to be positive. So this only works if u star is sufficiently small. It has to be smaller than, so v here, that was the dimensionless shear velocity, it has to be smaller than this value here. You can see if we have the Owen hypothesis and mu is 1, then this is infinity and everything is fine. If, for example, mu is 2, I mean, then this dimensionless shear velocity can only be 2 times the critical value, which I think we all agree that's not really a very, I mean, you can easily have natural winds where it's much higher than that.
But mu has significance in terms of the location of the focus point.
Exactly.
Yeah. So is this actually what Durand proposed in his paper?
Yeah, well, I should have said that. This, after I did this, I also read this paper by Durand and Hans Hermann, and they actually have a very parallel discussion. The arguments go a little bit differently, but the spirit of it is the same. So, absolutely.
And you are not happy with the idea that the focal point is actually not a point, but it's a line where all these points.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just discussing.
Okay.
No, maybe I actually like it, but I'm not sure. I mean, maybe I would like some of the more empirically oriented people to tell me what is up and down in this problem. I'm just discussing the mathematics of it at the moment, or the physics of it. Okay, but this is certainly worth having in mind that this so what this, as you said, the mu depends on the focal point. So this means that the focal point should not be too far away from the bed, because it would increase the larger the further away from the bed it is, the larger will be the value of mu. Okay. Then so we found this expression for the shear velocity at the airborne shear velocity at the bed, which was also equal to this. So we can now we have an expression for how the square root of pi depends on v, the dimensionless shear velocity, And of course, we also have an expression for pi and 1 minus pi. And now we can insert that into the expression for the winds, and we get this nice expression. And well, maybe it's nice to check that this is at least is consistent to put in this y bar. What is actually the value that we assume is fixed? What is this fixed value of the wind speed at the high y bar? Well, it's actually this, which is so if we have a grain-free flow at the critical shear velocity, then that's actually the wind speed at that height. So it just means that the wind speed just stays at the value it had before the saltation started, which, well, at least if it's constant, you wouldn't expect it to be far away from that value. And it's actually exactly at that value. So that's nice.
The wind speed at the height of the focal point stays the same.
Stays the same as it had before the saltation started. And in fact, now you refer to this other paper. This is actually how they did it. They started with this equation and it worked from that. And I did it in another way. So, but you end up with exactly the same because the two are consistent, which is kind of nice. And we get this expression for the flow from bed into air, and this expression for the transport rates, which is exactly the same. So here I have the reference to the Duran and Hans Hermann paper.
Maybe I'm completely misunderstanding, but if that is true, then it would mean that since if there is transport, basically about the y zero will be effectively larger than if there were no transport, and the velocity would go down to zero at a higher point. So where do you get the driving force from inside the delay between the bed and the focal point height?
I'm not sure I quite understood, but are you pointing out the fact that the wind speed below the focal point will decrease with
new star to the situation without transport?
Yes, that is true. Well, that is not really a problem because I mean there will be grains that jump very far high up into the air and it will extract momentum up in the high up, so it doesn't really matter.
And the interpretation is that the wind drives the saltation essentially above the focal point and is driven by the extra momentum of the grains that are below the focal point. They are faster than the wind there.
Yes.
You would say that. Yeah. If it's true that there's a focal point, I don't know about that, but Lechner claimed it, and some people doubt it. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I don't like it.
Okay, we're just discussing the consequences of such an assumption. Anyway, if this is true, then obviously it's very important to understand what is the value of pi, and the theory. Does not give that. I mean, there's no way I can see how to get it. It also doesn't say at what height y bar is the focal points. So here's the definition. So if we were able to empirically to determine the focal points, we should be able to do that if it exists. But then we have the problem that we do not know the function b. So the function b is obviously very important to understand this. We could do another thing. If we go up, so let's say that there's a top to the saltation layer where there's no more grains, let's call it t. Then if we go above that, well then, by the definition of b, so a here, that was how the rainborne shear stress decreases with height, and if we are above the transport layer, then obviously it must be zero. So B must be constant above this height. So if we plug in this constant, then we can rewrite the velocity profile like that. So we just get the usual logarithmic profile with a different roughness height, which is also something we should be able to measure from profiles in the wind free area over the saltation layer. And then we could just do a linear regression of the logarithm of these on this here, and then we would be able to determine mu, except that we do not know the function b. Maybe also do not, yeah. We do not know what t is, but that doesn't really matter. We just have to go far up. But obviously b is very important to determine what is mu. And well, personally, I would like mu to be very close to 1, so that we are close to the Owen theory that I somehow like. But that's something that would be very interesting to find out. Then, as I thought about this during the weekend, it reminded me that I had published a paper with Kjeld in 2005, because Kjeld had made measurements of the wind speeds. Well, not the wind speed, the grain speeds at different heights. And so I made a small theory that could predict grain speeds using this model that I just, this grain predictory model that I talked about, and some assumptions about the initial velocity. Well, here, so this is the wind speed, and these guys are the measured grain speeds, and the stars are the predictions by the theory, so it fits very nicely. I'm not really going to talk more about that, but remember that, so B was defined this way, and A was this B divided by B zero, and this function B was this, it's really essentially the difference between the expectation of the velocity of grains on the way down at height y and the velocity of grains on the way up at height y. So that means that it's actually something you could study empirically because nowadays you can actually measure these things. So it would be possible to, and maybe some of you guys already did it, to study empirically how this function b varies with height. I guess the problem would be that you can only do these measurements at a certain distance from the bed, and most of the action is actually taking place, you know, in the last few millimeters over the bed. So probably you will still have a problem of what is the actual magnitude of the, but because we have to normalize it by this guy here. But maybe it's possible to extrapolate into the bed. Another thing that has been, and I should maybe say that, another thing that has been done by Sauerman and maybe also others was to simply approximate A by a decreasing exponential function. And then, of course, with some parameter in it that would then be related to the height of the saltation layer. It's probably not a bad idea, but again, the height of the saltation layer is not so well defined, so it's again a problem. But I looked at this paper with Kjeld again, and looked at the formulae that I found, because there I found actually a formula for the mean value of the horizontal speed of grains on the way up and on the way down. And when I subtracted these two, then I get this nasty expression. So you can actually do some calculation. Maybe I need some explanation, of course. I made an relative to the model that I talked about before, I actually made this extra assumption that the wind speed is constant in the saltation layer. That's of course not true, but it makes calculations less formidable So it means that you went to the, should I say, the k's here are Bessel functions of a certain kind. And I assumed that the horizontal component of the initial velocity is an exponential distribution with parameter, an expectation 1 over lambda. And that the conditional expectation of the horizontal component given the, so this is the vertical component, this is the horizontal component, given the vertical component is this linear function of the vertical component. So this new is well, this, that's cotang of the typical start angle for grains. Well, the most nasty thing in this expression is this function u2 of y. It's actually determined by this equation, so it's given implicitly by this equation. And what it is physically, it's actually the smallest initial horizontal velocity that will allow a grain to actually reach the height y. So if the initial velocity, the initial vertical velocity is smaller than this value, then the grain will not reach the height y. So that's the meaning of this. And then there are some dimensionless constants. Here we have this fall velocity that I talked about before. The height y is made non-dimensional by this normalization. So there is a, this is certainly something I would like to look more into while I'm here, whether this can maybe be simplified or whether this can be used in some useful way to study how maybe a combination of theory like this and some empirical values would actually make it possible to extrapolate into the saltation layer or into the very dense saltation layer. Okay. Well, let me just finish this talk about transport rates by comparing to a number of other transport rates that have been formulated. If we write this non-dimensional transport rate in this way here, then there's this extra function of the dimensionless shear velocity. And well, Owen got this, Kind got this. Later, Owen got a simpler version of his theory. Longer and Half got this, and here are the ones I got. Sauerman got this somewhat complicated expression, also with Hans Hermann. And here's what I just derived now, and which is also what Joanne and Hermann got. And you will see that if we put mu equal to 1, then we get Owen's original formula. So somehow there's a nice nice circle that's kind of, we're getting back to maybe we're just beginning to understand Owen's theory a little bit better. I don't know exactly. Because he certainly just did a lot of approximations, but he had a fantastic intuition for stem transport. And so he just probably made all the right approximations. And it would be nice if it turns out that mu is close to 1 and then this is about right. I would certainly like that. But let's see. Now, I would also like to talk about the mid-air collisions, which is something different. In fact, it's something that screws up the whole theory that I've talked about now. Already in at a conference in Tempe in 88, I proposed this soft bed hypothesis, saying that at high friction speeds, probably there would be so much going on close to the bed that the bed would sort of be like soft and have different mechanical properties from at low wind speeds. Certainly, we could not be sure what happened at high wind speeds. At that time, I think Kjell can probably remember that most people thought I was being crazy, but nowadays, I guess, more people will believe that this could be right. But anyway, in a paper with Ian McEwan in 96, I was motivated by this idea to try to calculate what is actually the probability that a mid-air collision happens. Well, we did simplify things. So we think about the whole transport problem as we have some big saltators that make high jumps high up into the wind, and it extracts momentum, and then they splash down into the bed and splash up other grains, which will, when they make their sort of first jump, which will be relatively small, and there will be lots of these small ones that make small jumps close to the bed, which is why there's so much going on close to the bed. And maybe they make more jumps and gain more and more momentum and becomes one of the big jumpers, the saltators. But anyway, the idea is there's at least two populations of grains that make big jumps and extract a lot of momentum from the wind, and then the small ones that are just splashed up and do not really extract a lot of momentum. There are just lots of them down there. And what we try to calculate is to say, okay, suppose these reptators, as we call them, are just below 1 centimeter. So we suppose that one of these saltators is coming down, and since it's only the last 1 centimeter, we could just assume that it comes down in a straight line. The impact angle we just got from some numerical model of Ian's. We assume grains to be spheres of radius r. And yeah, I said that, and we just assume that the saltator move along a straight line. And then let's consider the time of a mid-air collision. So the time that the saltator then will hit one of these reptators down below the 1 centimeter. Of course, since the saltator moves with this speed, then there's only so much time here. At this time, it hits the bed. Let's see why denote the concentration by number of grains at height y. Then the probability that the saltator hits a grain between time t and t plus delta, given that it has not hit a grain before time t. Well, that must be, it's moving through this cylinder of radius r. It's moving with this speed u. So after time dt, it's moved through this cylinder, and there are this many grains in the cylinder. So that must be the probability of what we assume, that there's one or zero grain that it hits in this. What this determines is the so-called hazard rate of this random variable. And by standard probability theory, the probability density function then of this time t can then be expressed in this way. Now the probability of a mid-air collision, well, that's the probability that the grain does not hit the bed, but before it has a collision. So that's 1 minus the probability that goes down to the bed without hitting another grain. So that's this. And in fact, it's not so natural to express it in terms of the time. It's actually more natural to express the collision in terms of the height above the bed, which is given by this. And if you make this simple transformation, then we find this density function for the height above the bed where the impact happens. We see that this concentration profile is of course critical to calculate this. It can be expressed again in terms of of this quantity phi that we've seen before. This is the grain mass, and y is the vertical moment, the motion of the grain. One of these should have been a 2, sorry. This should have been a 2. On the way down, it moves down, that's hence the minus. But this is, I do not really know how to do this calculation. So what we did instead was I teamed up with Ian McEwan, who has this numerical model of Aeolian saltation that he developed with Brian Willits. And so he did some runs of his model for grains of this radius, 150 micron. And then we just fitted sort of exponentially decreasing curves to their data. And here's a plot from the paper. So these dots are the is that the output from the saltation model, and these are the lines that, so this is the log concentration, right? So these are the lines that we then fitted. You can see we are being pretty conservative because the, here close to the bed, actually the concentration is always considerably larger than what we so maybe we should have rather have fitted something to the last 3, but we didn't. We did this just to be conservative. We didn't want to overestimate the probability of grain impacts. Or media collisions, sorry. So this is then the probability of media collisions that we got. So he ran the model for different values of U star. These are the impact angles that we then used in the model. So the mean impact angle of grains, we just used the mean value because the impact angle actually doesn't vary very much. And these are the probabilities. So this is the probability of a mid-air collision as I defined it. So for small U stars, it's really small, but for the large U stars, it's very considerable. So most of the grains will actually hit the saltator on the way down. So there's no doubt that this is something that ought to be taken into account at high U star values. Another thing is what is the consequence of such a mid-air collision? Here's another. So these are the density functions of the height at which the collision takes place, height above the bed for different shear velocities. So this is the lowest, and as you see as the shear velocity goes up, the impact actually happens further and further away from the bed. And again, you can see we have probably been too conservative because at least for the high friction speed, certainly this continues like that. So we should probably have gone up to 2 centimeters at the high friction speed. But we didn't.
Is there any assumption about whether the flow is 2D or 3D?
It's 2D.
It's 2D.
Well, no. In fact, our impact collisions are actually 3D. But the basic model is a 2D model. I didn't say that perhaps clearly enough. So these saltators, they are just coming in the wind direction, right? In a straight line at this angle that we found. And all these reptators, we just assumed that they were hanging in the air, which is of course not true. But that was simpler. I mean, they are moving much more slowly than the saltators. Some are going up, some are going down. So we said, okay, they're just hanging in the air.
Is there like any difference between a 2D model and a 3D model? You sort of imagine that things might be able to avoid each other better in 3D than 2D.
Yeah, but the collision calculation is actually 3D, because we're actually looking at this tube So it is really, so the collision is really a 3D calculation. Otherwise, you're right. Otherwise, it would be probably totally wrong to use a 2D. Or give some bias that one could probably calculate. Okay, so now, and then we did this. So this is, now it's clearly a 3D. So this is the collision. So we assume the coefficient of restitution for quartz grains or sand size of this value, which we took from Anderson and Haff's paper in 91. And Ian also made some confirmatory experiments at the University of Aberdeen. At least that was what we used, and by sort of total standard collision physics, the velocity of the descending grain after a collision with a reptator would be this, where h is this guy here, and this is the velocity of the reptator after the collision, and then there are these angles that determine. So let's see. So phi, that was the angle of the incoming saltator. Alpha, that's so you make a plane perpendicular to the line along which the saltator comes in, and then you project everything onto that plane. And then alpha is the angle to the horizontal of the line that connects the two centers. And L is the distance between the two grains. Well, when measured on this, on the projection on this plane, this of course has to be smaller than 2r, and beta is defined in this way. Okay. This is just to see what happens after the collision. You do not get much wiser from this. You can calculate that 7 to 8% of the kinetic energy of saltators are lost if you take into account the kinetic energy loss per collision, and then the probability of a collision. I should also say that then we put a probability distribution on beta and alpha, so that assuming that the grains are totally completely randomly placed in relative to each other. But to really understand the consequences of this, we use again this simplified grain model that I talked about. Again, we assume that the wind profile is constant in this lower 1 centimeter of the saltation layer. And if you use that same model, then if we have a grain that at height y0 has this velocity. So now suppose y0, that's then the height at which the collision takes place. And then this is the velocity of the grain after the collision. Then the impact velocity when it hits the bed, now we assume that there are no further collisions, we assume it just continues down to the bed, then it will have this three-dimensional velocity vector, where ti is the impact time that's given implicitly by this equation. So now we can compare impacts of a grain, well, of the two grains after a collision, with the impacts of a grain that has not collided. Okay, what grain should we then compare to that has not collided? Well, what we did was then to choose a height y according to this probability distribution of the height where collisions take place. So, and now from this randomly chosen point, we just let this saltator continue with its velocity and then calculate this. But we used this model. We could actually just use the straight line, but we used this model. Okay. And now we can calculate things. So we now we need to assume something about I should maybe have said that already before. We need to assume something about to actually calculate the probabilities I showed you before. We also need to know the probability distribution of this impacting the saltator. And we simply got the probability distribution from Ian's numerical model. So we take this probability distribution from the numerical model, assume that the collision is random in a way that I said that we suppose that these two grains are, I mean, all the possible ways they can be rated or be positioned in order to relative to each other and still hit, we assume to be equally probable. And then we can calculate mean values. So here, this is from the paper. This is the probability density of the impact speed of so this is the impact speed of the reptator without a collision. This is the impact, the probability distribution. So speed is out here, meters per second. It's not so easy to see. And up here we have probability. This is a probability density of the saltator without a collision. And the other two lines here, this is the saltator after the collision. This is the reptator after the collision. They are almost the same. This is at a shear velocity of 28, 49, and 79. But in all cases, you'll see that after the collision, the impact speed of the two is almost the same. So it's not so clear what is actually the, but it's certainly smaller than it was without the collision. It's certainly much larger than here. So from this, it's not so clear what is the effect of these mid-air collisions. So we tried to calculate the horizontal displacement after the collision. So how far does the grain jump after the collision? Or if there's no collision, but that we pick the height at this random height according to the probability distribution of heights of collisions, so that we can compare it. And we can so this is without a collision, how far they would jump, and this is how far they jump after a collision. You see they jump much, much further. So probably what happens is that the saltator comes down and hits the other one, and then one of them will be pushed on and make another saltation jump without actually touching the ground. So it's just actually makes two jumps, so it comes twice as long without actually touching the ground. And that must have a profound effect, because you know the saltation is maintained by these constant splashes where the saltators splash into the bed and splashes up the new reptators that can then eventually develop into saltators, some of them. And if a saltator actually only makes two jumps instead of one, that certainly must have an effect on the transport rate. The picture is pretty complicated. So we tried to then calculate the number of grains ejected when the sand grains hit the surface. And we used a formula from Anderson and Haff's paper. They assumed that the mean number of grains that are ejected by an impacting grain is given by this, where B is the impact speed. And now, so this is without collision, this is with collision. How should you compare these? Well, in fact, if we should compare, so we should sort of see how many grains are a spaced up sort of well, the thing is that, this saltator, or at least there will be a grain that sort of makes two jumps without hitting the bed. So you really need to. It would be unfair to compare the collision case with just one no collision jump. You should really compare it to two saltator jumps to make a fair comparison. So you should really add these two numbers. So these are the two grains after the collision, and then you should add also the value for the saltator. And then you can see that in the no collision, even though here we have this extra jump, the number of grains that are splashed up So the number of grains that are splashed up is smaller than what you get if you add these. So that is consistent with the interpretation I just gave before. It is interesting that after the collision, actually more grains are splashed up than. So it's really only if you make this comparison where you add that you can see that the number of grains that are splashed up is going down. A final.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that the number of grains that are above the bed, because due to the collisions above the bed, you're keeping grains up.
That is true. That is true. But not that many. I mean,
okay.
Okay, we should talk. Maybe you can calculate other numbers that would be interesting. Mm-hmm. These are just the numbers we could think of. Here's a final table just to confuse us even more. So that's the mean momentum extracted by, from the wind by the saltator and the target grain after the collision, or no collision, but from a potential collision height. And this is somewhat confusing, right? But here they certainly, for some reason, extract. Well, they do extract more because they jump further, right? But probably what happens is that you know, it makes an extra jump, the saltator. But it already has such a high speed that it doesn't really subtract much momentum because it moves almost at wind speed already. So that's maybe the physics of it. Yeah. That would, well, I don't really know why it goes up and goes down. So it's the picture is complicated, and it's certainly something to think about.
How is the mean being over? Because also the momentum of the flow also increases. Is it normalized by that already?
No. We just use the equation of the moment to calculate how much is the so it's really the increase of the momentum of the grains.
So it's absolute momentum. It's not normalized by the shear force.
It's not. Yeah, there are probably lots of good ideas that you were asked to give me that would think that would be interesting. So
why would it drop at 90 even with no collision? Why would it drop? Am I missing something here?
I would really like to know.
Okay.
I don't know.
That doesn't make sense, does it?
No. There's one thing that one should also keep in mind here that so we got the input for this calculation from Ian's model, in which no collisions are assumed. I mean, that's a no collision model. So I mean, maybe what we get from that model is crap when we are down here.
No.
So I wouldn't be too worried about what happens here. So maybe we shouldn't. I mean, this is just some first calculations to try to understand what goes on, and We really had the plan to build sort of one of these stationary saltation models, sort of a numerical model, where we and we actually had figured out how to build in the collisions into it. But then Ian became interested in transport in water, and he is the one who could do the programming, because he was the one who had this whole machinery set up. So, and in the end, he ended in the Church of Scotland and has totally left research and is now taking care of the spiritual needs of people in Glasgow. So we never. It would really be nice to set up a model with where the effect of mid-air collision is built in into it too. I don't know how long you want me to go on.
Are you getting tired?
No, but I do not have that much more material.
But anyway. There's no. Usually we're limited at 3:15 because cookies are served. But because we have wine and cheese this evening, there are no cookies.
Okay, so I should have stopped already at 3:15. So you guys must be tired. Okay, I'm the one who's supposed to be jet lagged, but I'm not. So. I do not really remember what I. Yeah, okay. The last things I have are maybe not quite as interesting as this. So
you can stop now if you like.
Yeah, I think this is a good point to stop, and maybe if the other things I could maybe talk about at another time.
Okay, thank you.
Just a comment.
Yeah.
I think we are at the stage where we have enough experimental data to test all the assumptions you made in your model.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
To see which ones are wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And in your model, in fact, you don't consider the interaction between the particle and the bed.
No, not at all.
So all the assumptions which rely on the physics of the collision is in the of the Owen assumption or Bagnall focus point.
It's in the pi.
Yeah,
really. The pi contains all the information about the interaction between, and probably you could do much better than this. But at least it's a framework to think in.
Oh.
But more specific information about the bed would then permit some of the free parameters in the models to be perhaps eliminated.
That's true.
Okay. And I think Alexander has good experiments on the bed, in terms of this flash.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you guys about how to go on.
No more questions? All right. Thank you very much.